You're listening to By the Well, a lectionary-based podcast for preachers with Fran Barber and Robin Whittaker.
Hello, everyone. We're in the second Sunday of Lent, and today we're going to be discussing two of the readings, the Gospel reading Mark 8, 31 to 38, and the Old Testament reading Genesis 17, 1 to 7 and 15 to 16. If I know some lectionaries give the option this Sunday of Mark 9, the Transfiguration story. So if you're preaching on the Transfiguration, you might need to like to look at our episode from 2 weeks ago where I sat down with Brian Kalia and talked about that. It's B108. Or our episode from last year, A114, where we sat down with Dorothy Lee, who's written a whole book on the Transfiguration. So other resources exist, but we won't be talking about that today. So Fran, let's start with Mark 8.
So we are coming at Mark 8 just after Peter's confession at Caesarea Philippi that Jesus is the Messiah. And this is one of three of the passion predictions in Mark, the others being chapter 9 and
chapter 10,
verse 45-ish. This is a really punchy passage.
difficult.
That's difficult. There's lots of pairings of in and out and private and public. And there's really strong language. Well, Mark uses strong language, but this is a passage with some examples par excellence of strong language, and that there's no medium road here.
No, it's a demanding reading of costly discipleship that's very Lenten.
Yes. Yeah.
Should we do some exegetical things?
Yeah, I think, to start.
You know, it's notable here that verse 31 starts with Jesus teaching in the third person about the Son of Man. This is an apocalyptic. So he's just been revealed as Messiah to the inner group. Now he starts talking about the Son of Man, which a lot of scholars think is kind of synonymous with expectations of the Messiah, but a bit more of an apocalyptic persona, so the expected one.
Which is in keeping with Mark's whole flavour and, you know, the stage you set for this battle that's, or, you know, that's begun with Jesus coming, really.
Yeah. And there's also this must. Those of you who did a bit of Greek might recognise this word day, often read as a divine necessity that the Son of Man must suffer. It's necessary to suffer. I think there's two ways to interpret that. It could be divine necessity, so a theological mandate, but it could also be read as it is inevitable the Son of Man will suffer because of the conflict with the powers of the day. It's an inevitable consequence, I can't say that word, of human and cosmic conflict.
Yeah, which is, it sounds not that, they sound similar, those two reasons, but they're actually not.
No.
Because the first one suggests some sort of almost perverse need for something to happen just for the sake of the fact that I'm God who says it should happen.
Yes.
And the second one's actually, as you say, a consequence of the content of this message.
Yeah, and the nature of Jesus' ministry.
That it will threaten those in power.
Which I think is actually more in keeping with what follows. But
I agree.
And the other thing I'll say about this first verse, which really is we call it passion predictions because in the narrative of the text it's looking forward to what has not yet happened. But actually from the perspective of the author, these are really a synopsis of the gospel, that Jesus must suffer, must be rejected, must die and will rise again. And we get variations of this in Paul and other writers. I was struck by the inclusion of rejection. So suffering, we can understand rejection by, and he lists a number of Jewish groups there, and then death and resurrection. And I can't help but wonder if this is the perspective of Mark's context and place, and that Mark is acutely aware of the cost of being a Christian might mean you get rejected by your Jewish family and community. Like, we know that in some places, at least, not everywhere, there's also evidence that Jews and Christians lived very happily together for a few centuries at least. But in other places, there are stories of Christians being cast out of synagogues. So I wonder if rejection is actually a way of Mark signaling to his readers that Jesus knows the kind of thing you're experiencing.
Yeah, the cost that's been for you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What did you notice, Fran?
Well, he said all this quite openly. So, I'm interested in that that there's a secret about the messiahship, but then he quite openly talks about the suffering and the rejection and the death.
Yeah.
That's coming.
Yeah.
And then you've got Peter taking him aside.
Yes.
In the quiet again. But, of course, I'm really most struck by the word rebuke, rebuking one's teacher.
Yeah, which is just not done.
Well, I mean, it might be done a bit more in the 21st century Western way of doing things. But in the vast proportion of the world would not rebuke one's teacher.
No. And it's very strong language. It's the language Jesus uses in silencing demons.
Yep.
It's quite apocalyptic as well. So it has that sort of element.
He calls Peter Satan as well.
Yes.
To, you know, emphasize the point. And, you know, setting your mind on divine things on human things and not divine things.
Another one of those dualisms, human versus divine. Mm. Yep. Mm. I think the openly there is very striking. Like there's just been this revelation of Jesus as Messiah, which is shut down as secret knowledge, and yet this knowledge that Jesus will suffer and die
is
okay for that to be said plainly and openly. And it does. So in verse 34, this now expands to the crowd. So it's very explicit. It's the crowd and the disciples that he does this more public teaching to about the nature of discipleship.
Which is the crux of the passage perhaps and what most people would focus a sermon on. Speaking for myself, I will be doing that.
Just if we can go back to the Peter rebuke and the Satan, it's worth noting that Satan in this gospel is the tester. So Mark uses the same language of Satanus in the wilderness, temptation narrative. Satan in chapter 4, verse 15, in the parable of the sower, Satan is the one that comes and steals the seeds before they've had a chance to take root. So there's a sense of Peter behaving in that manner in presenting a kind of a human option to Jesus, which
a meddling.
Is...
It's a high-grade meddling.
Yes. Yeah, that's a good way to put it. The other thing to say there in the Greek, and I once wrote a whole article about this, is the get behind me, Satan, and I get annoyed when the Bible translates things differently in different places. The language of go behind me there is the exact same language Jesus uses in the call in 1:16 to like, there it's translated, come follow me, come behind me, or go behind me, you know, come go. But it's language of disciple. I would say it's language of discipleship and call. So it's a kind of a recall to Peter, like get back into your place as a disciple. Yeah, right. It's not your job to rebuke or to tempt.
Yeah.
Go behind me, come follow me again.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, then he talks about what following looks like.
Which is an important point because actually that's not a statement of rejection on Jesus. I mean, it is obviously it's a statement of rejection on Jesus' part because Peter's misunderstood, but he hasn't rejected Peter himself by sending him away.
No. No, exactly.
Which is what it does look like.
He's rejecting the idea. But, yeah, so the problem with the translation is it looks like he's rejecting Peter.
Yeah, that's it. You're out. You don't get it.
Yeah,
which is not good news.
No. Exactly. So, Fran, what do you make of these hard verses, in a sense? The if you want to become my followers, deny themselves, take up their cross.
Well, first of all, just that textual point that the deny word is what Peter will be doing of Jesus prior to his death.
Yep, in the so-called betrayal scene.
So I think you probably have to think a bit about the way the church has traditionally interpreted these words. So there's a sort of a spiritualizing approach. I'm saying that I would reject this.
Yep.
But that's what's been done. Sort of this idea that if you stoically bear the burdens of your life, then you'll get brownie points in heaven and, you know. So it's this awful approach to suffering.
Yes.
It's not that.
No, it's not that.
And I think the other thing to touch on is that the church has, in its many colonial forms, been very guilty of taking over the lands and resources and stories and peoples of other nations and communities and denying their selfhood.
Yeah, a different kind of denial.
Well, you know, and so calling all of that discipleship. You know, clouding all, clothing all of that with,
yep.
So I think that's to be rejected. And something I read might have been on a Working Preacher site, I can't remember, but that you can't deny a self that was never there. You know, you can't, that's never been acknowledged.
Well, that's a really interesting sort of psychological and pastoral point too, right? That often denial of self can become a, almost this martyrdom kind of in a problematic way of martyrdom.
And it's done, been done to women as well.
Oh, yeah. But you can't deny something that isn't there. So, like, you need to know who you are and what you believe to then be able to, in this version, voluntarily give it up or give it over
for
the gospel.
Your personhood to be taken seriously and, frankly, lovingly by your neighbour, you need to.
Yeah, so this isn't denial of self and your needs. And, I mean, I think, and for me the key, there's a key line in verse 35 about this saving life and losing it and losing life and saving it, for the sake of the gospel and for my sake. So if one is going to talk about costly discipleship this week and suffering and potential rejection and shame, it's not named, but it weaves through here that rejection and suffering is shameful in the ancient world, as is death on a cross. All these things are possible if you live a Jesus life, a Jesus-like life, but it's always for the sake of the gospel. So I think we need to name as preachers so clearly, this is not about telling particularly women, which as it's often been, to stay in places of suffering, to stay in abusive relationships, to stay in struggle. It's for the sake of the gospel. It's a very specific suffering. It's not generalized, oh, God is blessing your suffering and there's redemption in general suffering. I think we have to reject that theology so strongly.
There's some things I'd sort of explore briefly in the first place. So, and it's interesting, I was tossing up whether to say, are these words of liberation? That just sounds like a perverse thing to say, because to our mind, freedom lies in a lack of attachment to things and not being, in our modern minds, it's not being subject to other things and dictums and so on. That is not what freedom is in the ancient world.
Yeah.
And what we're being asked to be is liberated from our obsession with ourselves.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're in a culture that says that you find truth within yourself and that, you know, there's this eternal capacity for us to self-improve and we can buy books all about it. And that's actually
be your
really
best self.
Draining.
Yes.
So in that sense, these are liberating us from the secular gospel.
Well, yeah, and it's calling us to a greater purpose, which paradoxically is exactly what gives us life. When we stop being so self-focused, I'm not denying the need for self-care and all those sensible things, but when we stop making it all about us and actually focus on the other, there's a paradox there that we can actually find life and meaning in serving the other.
I mean, Willimon says of the Exodus is not a story of liberation. It's a story of seeking true enslavement.
Well.
And which, you know, fraught. But you could say that here. Like what are you going to be a slave? To things that are godly, that or things that are life-denying.
Yep.
And I think that's the sort of spectrum in which to look at it. And it's not about denying. I mean, Lent's a time when we talk about denying.
I know,
there's
giving
all that
up
penitential
stuff.
I prefer. I mean, you can't not talk about that in terms of the history of the church's use of living out of Lent, but there's also the adoption of disciplines of something. But this denial isn't about that sort of denial of the world and, you know, making things hard for yourself. It's actually the opposite. It's actually asking you, if you're living as Christ would have us live, you are in the world traversing the suffering of yourself, facing it honestly, and of your neighbour.
Yeah.
And that's where the cross is. You know, that's where if we forget the cross is at the forefront, we gloss over that reality of human existence.
I agree. And, I mean, circling back to he called the crowd, because I can't help but think of this vocationally, and it could be a week where preachers share some of their own sense of call, but for me the call to become a minister was not what I ever wanted. Was not what I was seeking. I was really hoping for something more glamorous.
Yeah.
You know, there are a lot genuinely other things I could have done that would have made me more money and other things. I'm not saying woe is me, I gave up so much. Because actually you know, my experience of the divine is when we follow God's call, we find our true purpose, and that is worth a million
dollars
times more, you know, a big paycheck or a whatever.
Or status, whatever.
Yeah, exactly. But I want to say, you know, in calling the crowd and saying this to the crowd, this is the level of discipleship call to everyone. And I sometimes think we think there's special disciples, you know, that the clergy and the missionaries and stuff. Mm. But actually, this is the demanding call on everyone. And it's hard to communicate that, but give it a red hot go, people, because, you know, this should reorientate everyone in the congregation's set of priorities and sense of.
Yeah, I mean, I'm having a go preaching on this week, folks, and I've come up with a sort of a question: will this thing, ordained ministry or studying nursing or being a parent or climbing Mount Everest, will this thing make me a better disciple?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a good checkpoint.
So, you know, that's actually what this whole text and Lent really is trying to sharpen our focus on.
If you're enjoying By the Well, please take a moment to review us wherever you listen to podcasts.
So we're now looking at Genesis 17, Robin.
Yes.
A reiteration of the covenant, which we first heard to Abraham anyway, in Genesis 12. And then 15, and here we are at 17. What would you point out to people to note in this passage?
Oh, there's so many things. where to start? I mean, in the lectionary cycle, just worth noting, we were with the Noah covenant last week, and now we're with the Abrahamic covenant. There are more covenants to come, but we're going to see some of the same dynamics of this being divine initiative. We'll talk in a moment about the theology that's sort of uncovered here in God making this covenant with Abraham. I honestly find this a problematic text because at a very surface reading, it can read as if God is saying to this one person, I'm going to give you someone else's land. And it's from the point of view of the victor, and there's zero regard in the text for how the Canaanites might have actually felt about that. And, you know, sitting here as an Anglo-Australian in a country where land was taken through violence and treaty never entered into with the Indigenous people, I can't help but wonder how a lot of people would hear this text when they might actually identify with the Canaanites.
Yeah.
So there's that context. I think when we actually get into the text, it's not that simple. And there's a different dynamic going on, but it's worth noting that this is a priestly text. It's probably written during exile, Babylonian exile. So even flipping that dynamic means you've got a people in exile who have actually just been dispossessed of the land. And I think that immediately.
Complex dynamic.
Yeah, it's a super complex dynamic. Yeah. So whether they're looking back and yearning for something that they felt was theirs or looking forward, which I think is a problematic interpretation, or looking forward to. You know, the land becomes a theological metaphor for
restoration
with God. So lots of things.
Like, first of all, 99.
Oh, yeah, and Abraham's pretty old. So, let's get into some exegetical points because there's also a lot of those.
Well, I think that's just an indication of how humanly – well, we get a greater glimpse of the humanly impossible situation Abraham finds himself in.
Yeah. Yes. And he has already travelled and been through some adventures and all of that. I was struck in that very first verse, and you can translate it two ways. It can either be walk in my presence or walk before me. And after reading the Mark reading, this command of God or this call of God to Abraham to walk before me is like the opposite of the Jesus walk behind me. But it has, Robert Alter points out in his translation, it has this sense of walking before me is before my face, which is kind of in my presence, so walking with me. And I think that relates to this land issue as well, in that David Carr in one of his books on Genesis points out that whenever land is talked about in the Abrahamic stories, it's always in relation to travel. So it's less about land per se and it's more about going somewhere. So the walk with me, the walk before me, again, takes us back to those themes of call and what is it we're walking towards with God.
And it's God in entering history, the people's history, which is a fundamental theological point that would have been very strange to non-Jews.
Yeah, Yeah, that's right. Other exegetical points?
Oh, well, I mean, the obvious one perhaps is that it's Abraham we meet in the first line, and it's Abraham.
By verse six or seven.
So just that whole key thing around names biblically being incredibly powerful, indicating obviously identity, but who does the naming, indicating belonging or authority.
Yep.
And the whole new identity and future that Abraham is entering in responding to God's covenant.
Yeah, and there's been a few people comment on what this name means. Both Abram and Abraham can have a sense of exalted father, something like that. Some people think Abraham, the longer version, actually has a sense of kind of father of nations or father of multiple, you know, multitudes kind of thing. So there's a significance or a wordplay in the name as well.
Yeah, yeah. For me, with both these passages, and I've got it underlined in red here, verse 3, then Abraham fell on his face. I'm interested, the lectionary leaves out verse 17 in
but
this
added
little
in.
Portion, but you could add it in that he falls on his face again in the before God, laughing derisively at the notion that he would have a child with Sarah. And we have Peter rebuking Jesus. So there's something here, there's a sermon there about how we respond to God, how we fall on our face metaphorically, and how God deals with us in the face of our response.
Yes. Yeah. Are we prepared to kind of almost bow to God's call or rebuke it?
And I was looking up, actually, there are about over 30 examples of people falling on their face in the Bible.
Oh, yeah. They're always falling on their face. Yeah, it's a kind of worshipful. Yeah. Also, in Hebrew culture or Semitic culture, it's what you do before a deity is you literally bow to the ground as an act of showing the hierarchical difference.
And which the laughing is very jarring and funny.
Yes.
Like that's a very funny.
Yeah.
I mean, it's humorous.
Because, again, it's Abraham flung himself on his face and then he laughed. It's almost like you can almost visualize him on the ground like killing himself laughing, which is less worshipful and reverential.
Yeah, yeah. So I think there's something there that people could explore. But in terms of a bigger picture response.
Oh, I'm not done with exegetical points yet.
Go.
Sorry.
Sorry, yes, we haven't talked about Qum, the established covenant either.
All right. Well, yeah, there's a couple of things. So in verse 5, we for the first time see the nature of this covenant, which is that Abraham will be a father to multitude of nations. So notice it's not one great nation.
Not just Israel, no.
And that gets repeated about three or four times, including for Sarah in the last bit of the passage, that Sarah will have a son, and she shall become many nations. Mm. So this emphasis on multitude of nations is, again, it works against that what I was saying earlier was a problematic, very narrow sense, which, of course, we see the legacy of today, that this is one nation who gets given one piece of land for all time, like that very simplistic literal reading, because actually it's expansive.
It's universal.
Yeah.
And I would draw a connection too with the word fruitful, exceedingly fruitful. So this is a restating of creation, Genesis 1, so that Abraham is this new person receiving again this covenant from God of renewed creation.
Yeah, and we talked last time when we talked about Noah that there were elements of recreation in that story about reestablishment after the flood. And again, if you imagine this as a people in exile who've seen their land destroyed by military might, people die, forcibly removed, they would have been surrounded by death and destruction. And in a sense, these writers are giving them yet another way to think about what recreation looks like through Abraham, an expansive vision of nations.
All the nations. Yeah. And also the emphasis on the everlasting nature of the covenant. So, you know, they're in a situation of profound discontinuity. Nothing's everlasting. Nothing's reliable at all.
But God is. Yeah.
And I think that's what I think is the fundamental theological point here. Just connecting with Lent 1 last week with Noah as well, that God is in the background of our Lenten journey. Well, and the foreground, obviously, hopefully.
Yeah.
But this everlasting promise to open a radical future that we can't design ourselves, that's the backdrop in which we hear Yeah. Jesus' words to take up your cross and deny yourself for the sake of the gospel.
Yeah, for me, theologically, this functions as a reminder to the people back then and to us that A, God is everlasting. So God's time is, you know, literally everlasting, but far broader than our own perspective in any given week or month or year. And that God is faithful and that God initiates this relationship. I mean, God doesn't, again, have to do this. God doesn't have to work with this particular human or any human.
Mm.
But there is the seeking of relationship, and the bit the lectionary leaves out is the requested response of a sign, which is circumcision.
Yes.
It can be read as a demand or an obligation. There's some debate amongst scholars about how mutual that is. But in fact, by calling it an everlasting covenant, the theology is it's everlasting regardless of whether you circumcise people properly or not.
It doesn't matter what you do, it is there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So which, God's word is abiding even if you humans all mess up and...
Which is not an invitation to mess up anyway because the covenant's there anyway, but that's getting into a Corinthian dilemma.
It's like that sin boldly kind of... No. People like to quote that bit of Luther that, you know, because there's grace, sin boldly. Well, it's not that. So big themes...
Well, I mean, I think that one I referred to about the God who calls us in Lent. So Lent's a time for really refreshing our orientation, our commitment, the nature of our call to discipleship. And that's some hard words that you hear.
Yeah.
But the background is this God. The God in Christ is the God who called Abraham, who rose Jesus from the dead.
Mm.
And this is the God who calls you.
And it strikes me just in what you said too with this laughing and Sarah giving life at the end of this passage and the link to Mark. I mean, in both of these texts, even though they can seem like hard demands, there is resurrection, there is life, there is, in this case in Genesis, new life, this vision of new sons being born, new families being made, new nations being created. So there's something in there for me I'm not articulating very well about, but, you know, again, that the call of God should always be one that leads to life-giving.
And if we think about what happens to Peter, I mean, he becomes the rock on which the church is built. He's not evicted from discipleship. We've already referred to that in the use of the get behind me, Satan.
Yeah.
But he just keeps on stumbling and stuffing up.
Yeah.
And
he's great.
He's still part of the core.
And becomes a key church leader from what tradition tells us.
So the other thing to say a bit sharper for this reading is that, I mean, what the Mark one does remind us is that people at the centre and the church are very capable of getting things wrong.
Well, and we know that when we see all these high-profile people against whom accusations of abuse and things are coming out,
There's that sort of wrong, but then there's also the failure to keep the cross at
yes,
the forefront
that's true.
Type of wrong.
More benign kind of wrongs,
So that's...
Yeah. I think for me, I mean, it never hurts to revisit discipleship and basic mission sort of call stuff. And I love this juxtaposition of the, what does it mean to come after Jesus, to walk in the manner of Jesus, but to go with God or before God into some unknown. I was thinking about congregations I've been with, and there's often a hankering back to the old, back to the glory days when people remember full Sunday schools and all that kind of stuff. But this is a God that calls us forward always into the new. It's not to say the new won't have elements of the past. It won't have big, deeply connected. But, you know, it's the come before me, the walk before me, walk with me. What does that look like in each context? I think is a real challenge.
Yeah.
By the Well is brought to you by Pilgrim Theological College, the Uniting Church in Australia, and produced by Adrian Jackson.